This episode of On the Media is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of On the Media, NPR, and other shows while on the go without downloading or syncing with Stitcher Smart Radio. Thousands of popular podcasts and programs are available on demand. Stitcher instantly delivers new episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone without syncing or downloading. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/media.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone, reporting this week from Cairo. Friday, April 8th. Protesters gather in Tahrir Square. It's the biggest demonstration since the revolution began here on January 25th, ultimately ending Hosni Mubarak's rule of Egypt, where he presided over 30 years of dictatorship and decline. This was, is, a revolution about economic opportunity, human rights, justice, and democracy. It is not about religion. Although thousands around me are jammed together, kneeling on broken cement and mud, with their foreheads resting on rugs or scraps of paper, on the backs of those kneeling in front of them in prayer. Those who are not Muslims stand with them, respectfully. Never have I seen a revolution so fired by faith that is not about faith. Bukra inshallah malesh. Tomorrow, God willing, never mind. Once the unofficial slogan of Egyptian life for a people whose patience had devolved over time into passivity and then paralysis. But that's all over now. In 12 hours, this square will erupt in bloodshed as protesters calling for Mubarak to be tried for his crimes, joined by some uniformed military and members of the Muslim Brotherhood, violate a late-night curfew. Shots are fired. Eyewitnesses blame the military. The military blames the remnants of Mubarak's National Democratic Party. The world first hears about the melee on Twitter. About a quarter of this nation of 80 million are online. Pretty impressive, considering that another quarter of the population is illiterate. We're here to probe the problem of where and how people get their information at a time when clarity has never been more crucial and news outlets more distrusted. Having first denied the protests and defended Mubarak, then denounced Mubarak and celebrated the revolution. We start by asking people in the square about their news consumption.
ناصر فرج unemployed.
أخبار من القنوات زي الجزيرة ودي قناة بثق فيها جدا ماشي زي العربية ودي قناة بثق فيها جدا ودي سندتنا في الثورة في الوقت اللي التلفزيون بتاعنا خزلنا فيه.
Jazeera and Arabiya, these are two channels that I really trust because they supported us during, and Al Hurra channel, because they supported us during our revolution at the time that our own television let us down.
Well, Sayyid, بدون عمل.
Unemployed. We just graduated and we're not working.
نقرنون بس مش الأكيد أكتريتها كلها يعني كلام فاضي.
I get it from the newspaper, but it's not information that I trust. And they don't give you the truth. طب ليه ما بتروحش على الإنترنت أو كده؟
ما عنديش طبعا جهاز أجيب منين طيب؟
And I don't have money to get a computer or internet access.
أنا مهندس عصام عبد الموت.
Engineer Isam Abdel Mouat.
بالنسبة للإعلام المصري كتلفزيون حتى رغم التغييرات اللي حصلت فهي تغييرات شكلية فقط ولكن لم تدخل إلى الجوهر. ما فيش تغيير في الفكر نفسه.
The changes that were introduced to the Egyptian media were only in the appearance. There is no change in the way of thinking itself.
ليه ما يتمش تعيين ناس من شباب الثورة المثقفين في التلفزيون؟ ليه ما يتمش الاستعانة بناس جديدة في التلفزيون؟
Why don't they employ some of the youth from the revolution in the television or bring in new blood?
إبراهيم زغلول السعيد بشتغل عامل يعني بسيط بجيب شوية فلنات أبيعها.
إبراهيم زغلول السعيد I'm a simple worker I buy some shirts and I sell them back.
ما أعرفش الإنترنت لا ما اعرفش خالص ولا اعرف البتاع اللي هو البوك ده ولا البتاع ما اعرفش
I don't know the internet at all, and I don't know this book thing that they talk about.
People besiege the microphone as if it were their only chance to be heard. One girl waves a picture of her brother arrested when applying for government assistance after a fall. Egypt's mainstream media have rarely given voice to the voiceless. Instead, they lied or lie.
I've worked in a number of either state-owned or state-sponsored newspapers and television channels.
Faisal J. Abbas, London-based journalist, commentator, and blogger, spoke to us before we left.
You know, I can tell you from my own experience that the resemblance is amazing between the state of the country or the regime and the way it's reflected in journalism or in these media institutions. You have editors-in-chief who've lasted for 20 or 30 years. And, you know, when you go inside the organization, you'd find, you know, this exact same symptoms as a dictatorship. So anybody who takes the liberty to speak his own mind, you know, will be questioned and, you know, he might be harassed and bullied. And those who praise the dictator, praise the editor-in-chief, those people will be promoted and things like that.
But that was then. Today, Egypt's state-run outlets declare that they've thrown off the yoke of the dictator and plead for a chance to redeem themselves. They claim that the revolution has erased the red lines around such taboo topics as religious minorities, torture, sexual harassment, Mubarak's personal life, and the military. But human rights activists say one red line still remains, the one pertaining to the last remaining institution with unchecked power, the only one that matters, the military. In part, that's because the military stood with the protesters by refusing to defend Mubarak.
The majority, they do like the army, and they don't want to believe that the army is a bad entity. And whatever the army is doing, people think that it's for the public good. So if they're torturing, it's okay.
Rami Raouf works for the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, where he collects and posts online testimony about the military's kidnapping and torture of demonstrators and videos of abuse.
But many international outlets like BBC, CNN, and Al Jazeera, they did different documentaries about what we said online, and they gathered the videos that we posted online and built kind of report saying that there are accusations for the army and blah, blah, blah. It's kind of embarrassing for local newspapers that every international outlet is speaking about something that no one inside is speaking about it.
So this is an interesting trajectory. The taboo against covering military abuses is so intense that it begins online, travels into the international press, and hits there. A roadblock.
Yeah, and stops there. It doesn't come to a local newspaper in Egypt.
But he concedes that he stands at least a chance online. Online versions of mainstream papers are freer than the paper ones. English language versions are freer still. Online independent papers even more so. While mainstream newspapers hemorrhage readers, internet journalism grows in influence, if not in revenue. Khalid Albashi edits the successful online paper Al Badil with two staffers, money from an inheritance, and a host of volunteers. He used to run the paper version of Al Badil until it was closed down for financial reasons. He says political pressure was put on the paper's funders to withdraw. That seems likely. He's been sued by officials dozens of times, never been convicted.
At the end of the day, I know how to write what I want without getting jailed. Unless they want to detain me, then that's a different issue. But to get imprisoned for something I wrote? No. I know how to deal with existing laws.
That's quite an acrobatic feat. Egyptian defamation laws have landed journalists in jail for writing about the president's health or calling a politician's performance bad. Insulting the police can result in kidnap or torture, but Albashi knows the ropes.
We withhold the accused officer's name, but we know his initials are so and so. That way, I present the complete facts, but he can't file a lawsuit against me. But ultimately, I would have exposed him. This is part of their problem dealing with me, because they weren't able to imprison me. So they decided to close my newspaper. This is part of the problem.
Information is power.
Gamal Eid is the head of the Arabic Network for Human Rights Information in Cairo.
When people has the information, they can get the right decision. But without information, forget any right decision. For example, till now, the document for the war of 1967. We don't know exactly what happened. We are talking about information about more than 40 years.
That was a serious low point for the Egyptian press. During the first 3 days of the Six-Day War, the Egyptian media, including a respected announcer on state-run Nile TV, claimed victory over Israel when, in fact, the Egyptian army had been crushed. Gamal Eid says that the government has yet to set the record straight.
And we have a right. It's our history. It's our country. But nobody can touch this document. And we're going to fight for our right for information.
Megda Abu Fadil is director of the journalism training program at the American University of Beirut. And she says journalists in Egypt are in full mea culpa mode right now.
A famous talk show host who can claim that he was made famous during the Mubarak regime, for example, was interviewed recently in a newspaper, and he said, "We're a defeated generation. We said half-truths or we lied." Now each one of them is trying to find its own identity and get its own act together. Now where it all leads, you know, we're kind of in a holding pattern and hoping for the best, but it's one heck of a ride.
Heck is a polite word for describing any ride on Cairo's potholed, gridlocked streets. We spent a lot of time in taxis. All the music you'll hear in this hour is recorded from their radios. Next, we stop at Cairo University's J School and the Middle East's once greatest, now most debased daily, Al Ahram. This is On the Media. How did you feel when you saw that infamous photograph of Mubarak doctored walking in front of the national delegation rather than behind?
I was embarrassed to be an Egyptian journalist when I saw that picture, and of course I wasn't happy because everybody was making fun of me.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone in Cairo. We slip past the guards at Cairo University to check out an ongoing sit-in at the School of Mass Communications, now in full swing with placards and banners and a fair measure of flirting. The students demand Dean Sami Abdel Aziz, a revolution-denying, rigged election-defending Mubarak crony, must go.
The principles of press, or the principles of media in general that we learn, are in complete contradiction with the opinions of the dean. We are taught to have credibility, not to mislead public opinion, and to observe neutrality in presenting issues. And the dean defends ferociously and with all his power a regime that corrupted and destroyed the country.
A fight breaks out when some young men are ejected after trying to crash the sit-in. Actually, no one is sitting. These are stressful times, mini-revolutions everywhere as the institutions built to support the old regime are breached. Students here learn solid principles of journalism, but to use them, they've been obliged to go abroad to Al Jazeera or the BBC. And that might seem strange, given that the most storied newspaper in the region, a 136-year-old monument to journalism, is so nearby. We hail a cab. Al-Ahram is Egypt's most widely circulated daily newspaper, though not necessarily the most read. State-owned, the government appoints the top editors and controls the presses. Riddled with deadwood and internal corruption, the paper's nadir probably was reached in September 2010 when a blogger revealed that it had doctored a photo of Middle East leaders walking with President Obama so that Mubarak appeared to be leading the group instead of Obama, when in fact, the Egyptian leader was bringing up the rear. Osama Saraya, Al-Ahram's editor-in-chief, called the altered photo expressionist, depicting Mubarak's leadership role in the peace process. We've arrived and run into Khalid Daoud, back after 9 years as an American correspondent. He's returning, he says, like many other foreign-based Egyptian journalists, to help build democracy at home. So why all those years in the U.S.? It was a strategy to avoid conflict. For instance, he says he didn't have to report, as home-based reporters did, on mythical Mubarak supporters in the street during the revolution. Away from the mothership, you're less likely to confront moral dilemmas.
You simply use your own tactics, like many Egyptian journalists, of avoiding the stories that will put you in a bad position or make your name look bad. And if worse comes to worse, they force you to write one story, you can file it without having your byline on it.
How did you feel when you saw that infamous photograph of Mubarak walking in front of the national delegation rather than behind?
I was embarrassed to be an Egyptian journalist when I saw that picture. And of course, I wasn't happy because everybody was making fun of me. But more important, I just told myself that if a government newspaper wants to satisfy the president in such a cheap way, this is definitely a regime that's not going to stay for long.
What's your beat here?
I cover regional affairs and I also cover the local political scene.
What's going to happen the first time you push against the red line?
My article won't get published.
Upstairs, we are greeted by Al-Ahram's new editor-in-chief, replacing the old expressionist one, Abdel Azim Hamid, a longtime Al-Ahram hand who briefly left for an independent paper and then returned. An unscientific poll of reporters tells us that they can't quite read him yet. I certainly couldn't. He says Al-Ahram's comeback will be a piece of cake.
So Al-Ahram is well established in the Egyptian consciousness. It is part of our culture, so it is easy for Al-Ahram to regain the confidence of the readers.
But we've talked to people who have worked at Al-Ahram, people who have read Al-Ahram, and the fact is, it's not going to be easy. So be honest with me, what's the big challenge? What is the first thing that you need to do?
I think it is not now to replace the chief editor. He was responsible for everything gone wrong in Al-Ahram. Of course, the change of the regime liberated all of my colleagues. It is a week now, just 1 week. So it is hard to answer every question, to know everything.
So what is your goal for this week, if you had one? And what would be your main goal for next week?
My main goal for this week is to change the people of the central desk of the newsroom. The desk who is in charge of all the pages of the newspaper and should be headed by the chief editor himself.
So those people have to go. Is that going to happen this week?
Not all of them, of course.
And next week?
Next week to pick up some new face to supervise the editorial section.
So, this week, get rid of people. Next week, replace them.
I hope so.
And the week after that?
Oh, it is enough. It is a lot of questions now. I think it is enough now. I'm so sorry.
Okay, thank you. He threw us out of his office. So, we picked up with enterprising business reporter Saba Hamamu, lately suspended for investigating corruption within Al-Ahram, and then reinstated after the revolution. She sees a future for press freedom at Al-Ahram, inshallah.
This is kind of transformational period. The army shouldn't be in charge in a few months from now. We should have, parliament election and presidential election. So the army won't be there forever. And I would love if we can have this chance to, objectively report whatever happening in army or anywhere else. But to be honest, I'm not, thinking this is what gonna be happen.
because of patriotism, because of a sense that it would be destabilizing, or because it would be very much discouraged by the editors, or why not?
I don't think the editors will take this risk. Because we are owned by the government, we are not independent. So, and the decision for appointing editors right this second is going to the sole power in the country. My opinion, my personal opinion, they won't take this risk.
Why not go to an independent paper here rather than to the paper that was the mouthpiece of the regime?
Because we want this place to bring, as Tahrir people brought Egypt back to the world, as you know, to the place it deserves, as the country that everybody looking at this moment. Why don't we try to bring Al-Ahram back to Egypt, as you know, the most, in my opinion, it's been the most credible and most prestigious newspaper in the region. It's the oldest in the newspaper, and it's one of the most important 10 newspaper worldwide. So why don't we give it a try and do our best? Let's do that. If we failed, خلاص, we failed. I will go to another place, or I'll quit. I'll do anything else.
History is against her, the laws are against her, and for now, the political establishment led by the military certainly is against her. Last Sunday, a military tribunal convicted 26-year-old Michael Nabil Sanad of insulting the army by reporting military abuses on his blog. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison, the first trial of a blogger since the military took over in February. Young bloggers are on the front line in the information war, and Mona Saif, a 25-year-old grad student in cancer research, is one of its field marshals, having used social media to keep thousands connected to events in Tahrir Square and now in Libya, Bahrain, Yemen. I guess you could call her a Twitter node. It was late, and she'd just left the lab when we met in a cafe called Bon Appetit, just down the street from Tahrir Square. What's a nice girl like you messed up in a revolution like this?
I don't know. Everyone I know is involved in this revolution, nice girls or not very nice. So just to tell you what revolutions could do to you. There's this young actor, his name is Esir Yassin, and yani, among my generation, he's one of the most handsome young actors. And when I started working on military trials of civilians, I was working for one case in particular at the beginning for a guy called Amr al-Bihiri, because I was a witness to the army beating him up. So a friend of mine who works in filmmaking told me he's going to contact his friends and do like a small film to say that they are against military trials of civilians. And so he contacted Esir, and they did the video, and it was really good. And my friend called me, and he's like, okay, one of the channels of State TV called Esir Yassin, and they want to have an interview with him about Amr al-Bihiri's case. And since he doesn't know much about it, he has to sit with you to get more info about it. And I started laughing. And I was like, yes, revolution got me everything I want. Mubarak out. And Esir Yassin calling me on the phone.
Can you remember the first thing you ever posted online?
Back in 2006, I wrote a very personal post about how I've been following the blogs and how suddenly I want to be part of this space and see what it does to me and like sort of explore it. Only a month after I started blogging, we had a big incident of mass sexual harassment for girls in downtown. And most of the girls I knew who had blogs, we suddenly decided very spontaneously to use our blogs as a space to share this experience, to share how it was being a girl in Egypt and how you sort of go through sexual harassment experiences every day. And suddenly there was this whole campaign against sexual harassment. Girls who usually wouldn't have dared to write about this suddenly gained support by the idea that others are doing the same. And it was the first time for me to be part of a social campaign that uses online tools and that comes out to one particular instant that triggers it and makes it much bigger.
Did you have any contact with mainstream media, or were you just working along a parallel path?
Mainstream media had contact with us. They used to seek us out, and even this happened in Tahrir. It didn't need effort on our part to try and reach out for mainstream media. Once you got the word out on the alternative media and social networks, either mainstream media picks it up and follows you to get updates, or even if mainstream media were reluctant to do that, eventually the buzz in the blogosphere and in the social media pressures them to talk about it. When we had the referendum, it was a vicious battle online. So in that sense, social media is really being used, and really being used much more than anything else, because we don't have real spaces in which these kind of debates usually take place.
What is your focus now?
Military trials of civilians. Since the army has taken control, we have thousands of civilians who have been tried before military court. The trial itself does not guarantee justice, and our mainstream media will not approach the subject. We have a couple of cases that the army have declared they are going to review it and retry them again after they were sentenced. All this has been done using social media. Social media will always be the first channel we use to approach subjects that mainstream media or the regime is reluctant to. And it seems that people in power are understanding this. For example, the army's main method of communication with the people is through Facebook. They have an official Facebook page. When they want to declare a statement, it is first announced on Facebook, not in main state media, not in newspapers. First thing they announce it is a statement on Facebook. So even those in power understand that now the way to the people is through social media.
Where do you get most of your news?
My main news source is Twitter now, whatever the issue is. And by time you acquire a list of people that you know who are really credible, and so you trust what news they are sending your way, which is like you do with mainstream media. And even when revolution started in Libya, I sent out to the people I trust on Twitter asking for sources in Libya, and eventually I learned and I gathered my own group of tweets from Libya to follow their news. The same thing happened for Bahrain and everything.
So you've created your own list of essentially news aggregators, because a lot of them will send you links to mainstream journalism. It isn't all just citizen journalists, right?
It isn't at all. It's pointers. It gives you an indication of what is in the list of hot topics. It gives you an indication of which are the best things to read. It sort of works as a filter and an aggregator at the same time.
Is there any Egyptian media right now that you trust?
Some and some. In the past 2 months, I've been completely absorbed in the issue of military trials and military violations. It made me realize more and more it takes a lot of guts to approach this subject. And I see this with a lot of people online, but I didn't see it with a lot of the independent newspapers. It made me sort of review my assessment of each paper I've been following or reading.
How they deal with the military is kind of a litmus test for you?
Yes, absolutely. How much they are willing to take risk for, you know, the greater good of human rights and protecting those who do not have people to protect them or not. So,
your media consumption seems to begin and end online.
I think my generation, definitely for them, their main space is the online one. But I also see that most of the people of my generation are still aware of the importance of traditional journalism and news coverage, and they are trying to move from the online form of it and invade the traditional methods. I would give you an example on that. A group of young people from Tahrir Square, right after Mubarak stepped down, they started an informal underground newspaper called El Gornal. They distribute it online, but they print it. Their last issue had a huge coverage on military violations. The first issue, they printed 10,000 copies. This last issue, they printed 25,000, and they are trying to push for more.
Why?
It gives you access to a different audience. It gives you a different access. And because even for me, I still like to hold something in my hand and read it, and it's not a bad thing. So it's not as if we are disposing with one means and then moving to another. We are pushing to change the other traditional forms to fit our expectations.
Are you working in your field?
Yes, I am. My work in particular is on BRCA1 gene, which is one of the genes connected with breast cancer incidence, and I'm investigating the mutation pattern in Egyptian patients.
You're working full-time at that?
Yes, absolutely.
And you're working full-time, really, as an activist?
I guess so. Both are very consuming, time and energy and emotions. And I'm only starting to get the handle of doing both at the same time and juggling between my activism and my work.
A lot of people say the problem with citizen journalism, leaving aside whether it's accurate or it's well-researched, is that it's not professional in the narrow definition that you aren't paid. And if you aren't paid, then you can't entirely devote yourself, and that's why you need a professional journalism class of people.
Paid or not does not define you being professional or not. I'm practically not paid in my research, and yet I'm doing it, and it's my real job. For the citizen journalism, I think this is why the actual product for me seems more professional, because what pushes people to do it is not to earn their money, but because they are fully committed to this particular cause that they are working on. And for me, I started working in military trials because fate had it that I was personally involved as someone was getting beaten up by the army and then falsely accused. And so I felt really personally about it, and I'm working really hard. I'm not sure if I was actually paid to do this job, if I would have worked as hard as I am doing now.
Do you think neutrality is important to producing good journalism?
No, absolutely not. I hate it when people push neutrality against me when we are talking about obvious violations. Whenever I saw the term neutrality, it was always to justify not covering the brutality of police or regimes or whoever in power.
What about the problem of accuracy?
I always find it funny when people ask about that, because we have printed newspapers that are complete rubbish, and they publish lies all the time. So use the same methods of judging and assessing any news source, whether they are professional journalists or citizen journalists. Nothing is given. People of my generation, because of all the what we have experienced, they are less likely to believe anything coming out of an official, for example. And they would always check first online or with their own personal networks that they have developed to check the facts. It's not as if we've never had rumors before spread, and now that we have social media, there are rumors spread. It's just another space where you have to use the same mechanisms you used to use in the real world, but adapt them to this new virtual world.
Coming up, can state TV get its mojo back? Or is the future on YouTube? This is On the Media.
This episode of On the Media is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio, offering the Stitcher mobile app. With Stitcher's free app for mobile phones, listeners can get the latest episodes of On the Media, NPR, and thousands of other podcasts on demand without downloading or syncing. The free Stitcher Smart Radio mobile app can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with my producer, Sara Abdurrahman, hitching a ride to the pyramids with Mohammed Khalifa, the director of a new, cool YouTube show you'll be hearing more about. He's a TV guy, so I asked him which TV outlets best covered the revolution.
The foreigner media played a very big role in the Egyptian revolution. In the time when the Egyptian media didn't say anything about the Thawra and the revolution and stuff like that, only the foreigners would hear and reporting that. So this is how people trusted people who were in the revolution. They trusted the foreigner channels, like Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, Al BBC, CNN, even though I don't like CNN that much, but at the same time, you know.
What about Anderson Cooper?
I like him. I have no problem with him.
Not crazy about CNN, but likes Anderson Cooper. Some things are universal. Also universal, distrust of Egyptian television.
It's very, very painful for me to say that Egyptian television wasn't able to tell what was happening in Egypt. Our sources were BBC, Al Jazeera, CNN, and all other channels. We wanted to know just what was happening outside our building.
Suha Nakosh worked at the Egyptian Radio and Television Union for 20 years. She was doing newscasts on Egyptian TV when the protesters launched the revolution in Tahrir Square. We met her in the Chantilly Cafe in upscale Heliopolis.
I studied journalism in Cairo University. I graduated in 1991. And when they started the project of Nile TV International with both languages, English and French, I switched to TV, and I had the feeling not only doing the job I love, but also I had a dream. I had this dream to represent Egypt and to create a small circle of good professional journalism in Egypt. I had this dream. I wasn't alone in this dream. All the group of Nile TV International had this dream to start to make a good journalism, TV journalism in Egypt.
And when did the dream die?
The dream died gradually. It was every day and it was everywhere and in every news bulletin we do. We focus on the news of the president, his son, the National Democratic Party. That day in Cairo, there was the demonstrations, there was clashes between police and the demonstrators, there was injuries, there was killed people. I had the difficult mission to go on air on the top of every hour and tell the people that Cairo regains its calm. On the top of every hour, I wasn't in peace with myself. I was lying, it's clear. I admit that we had to lie in the past years, but on that day I had the feeling that I have to take the decision to be on the part of those people who chose to defend one family and one party, or to be with the people defending all our rights.
So she quietly walks away from her career in state TV forever. A couple of months later, the head of Egyptian television is sacked along with two anchors, and a fresh new face walks into the spotlight.
My name is Bessel Sabri. Currently, I'm the show host of, you can say, the primetime talk show on Egyptian television, which is Masr al-Naharda, or Egypt Today.
Egypt Today is widely viewed 2.5 hours a night, 6 nights a week, on a network that has to do a complete turnaround if it's to be regarded as anything other than a sick joke. Basile, who used to work in the relatively more free foreign language service, has a big job ahead. Can you speculate why the people who hired you hired you?
First of all, there is an image problem because Egyptian television has been associated with so many lies and so many misinformation in the previous regime. The faces of anchors, the backgrounds, the studios, everything says old regime. I think that's one of the reasons that I have been chosen for this, because I'm a new face to most of the people. They're not sure how am I affiliated, but they think that a change in faces is very essential.
Many people like to say there are no red lines anymore, but everybody knows that there's still a big, bright, thick red line around the military. What are you going to do when you bump up against it?
Okay, that's a good question. The military intervened at one point in the revolution and averted Egypt going down the same path as Libya or Iraq. They have to be credited for that.
I think they have been credited for it. Now they have to answer for the current moment. There's been a lot of online documentation of people who were taken into custody and abused. But this kind of material doesn't make it onto television. Have you talked about it?
We haven't talked about it yet because I've been on air for only 8 episodes and there are so many subjects that we need to discuss. Mm-hmm. And there is no really subject that is a taboo at the moment. If there is, and I discuss it, you will find me off air the next day. And if I get taken off air, I don't care.
So the prospect of losing the job doesn't bother you?
It doesn't bother me at all.
What about the prospect of going to jail?
If I get taken to jail, people will know why I was taken to jail. Because they see me on air, they see what I say, and it would be very strange, very weird if I get taken to jail.
No, in a way, it's a great situation because you are so public that if you do push against that line, if you do report something that under the current repressive press laws amounts to defamation, if they punished you, everybody would know. That's a tremendous amount of power. Do you think you might use it?
Yes, I will.
He says he will.
Meanwhile, Egypt's independent satellite channels, most notably Dream TV and On TV, have no legacy of lies to contend with. Instead, they bask in the glory of reporting fairly on the revolution. Still, the heavy lifting of the information revolution happens online, not just in assembling testimony about the abuses of a nearly untouchable institution or peering into the crannies of political corruption, but in shaping the way Egyptians think about those things. Which brings us to Bassem Youssef. This is not the theme for the Bassem Youssef Show, although it was written by its sound designer. At the moment, this lightning-paced YouTube production hasn't got room for one, but someday soon it may. Bassem Youssef's audience is growing as fast as a snowball rolling down a hill, and it exemplifies everything that is new about media in post-revolutionary Egypt. As goes Bassem, his producers contend, so go the Egyptian media. And as go the Egyptian media, others speculate, so go the rest of the regions. Egypt's revolution was driven by young people sharing information online. And the way people communicate online is different.
When people talk about internet video or internet viewership, it's usually labeled as a lean-forward experience, that you need to sit close to your computer and watch the person talking to you and talking real, saying the real deal to you online.
Tarek Al-Kazaz is general manager at Baraka One Web, a production company that is actually making money posting original content on YouTube, itself a revolutionary act. But when Tarek cooked up a show starring his old friend Bassem Youssef, he was enmeshed in the other revolution in Tahrir Square, where Bassem, a heart surgeon, was attending to the wounded. Tarek told him,
I need to shoot something for the revolution, and I know that you have Jon Stewart everywhere in your in your being, okay? And I'm like, let's do the Egyptian version.
I always dreamt of having something like this in Egypt, where you actually have no limits in satire.
Bassem Youssef venerates Jon Stewart.
I mean, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert works on how ridiculous the media is. And the 18 days of the revolution, we just like topped everybody. I mean, we were actually the home of stupidity. It was like juicy. Oh, yes. Wow. I mean, that was a gold mine.
The Bassem Youssef Show is formatted like The Daily Show, minus the interview. An appealing everyman sits in front of a screen airing absurd clips from the media, the bizarre statements of politicians, and reacts accordingly with wisecracks and funny faces and the occasional prop. He's the rational viewer's surrogate who, in desperate times, is in desperate need of a laugh.
I'm amazingly modest and fantastically humble, and I'm really, really up there in being down to earth.
This is the lean-forward experience Tarek mentioned, at once intimate and communal. That's The Daily Show, something that was never possible in Egypt before now. Egyptian political satire is practically an oxymoron. So when Bassem shows a clip on state TV of a source crying crocodile tears...
It must be eaten again.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And then opens the envelope to award the prize. It startles. Bassem's is the most subscribed to show on YouTube in Egypt. It's expanded from around 5 minutes to 15 minutes or more. And last Friday, he drew legions of fans when he dropped in on the ongoing protests in Tahrir Square. His favorability ratings are soaring.
We don't want lies.
Amir Ismail is Bassem Youssef's executive producer.
We are living 30 years of lying on each other. It makes us hating each other. So right now, people are close to each other. They want the truth. They want everything to be clear. Clearness is very important in the media, in social life, in dealing with each other. Just clearness.
Mustafa Halawani is a full-time composer. He wrote the theme we heard earlier for a movie. But he's also the show's sound designer.
Do you feel like you're working on something that could change the country?
Yeah, very much, yeah. It's gonna change the comedy in Egypt and this kind of shows big time. Here in Egypt, we are used to laugh even in the worst situations. And I'm sure you have seen this, like in Tahrir Square, in the middle of the revolution. All the things that people were screaming.
And the signs they carried, exhorting Mubarak to...
leave because my wife is about to deliver. And, you know, funny stuff like leave because actually I need to go to the whatever hairdresser or something.
That kind of caustic rebuff to power gets no airing in state media. Even the local satellite channels, so much freer, don't smirk in the face of guns. But it's spilling onto the internet in shows like Bessem Youssef's. Topics of past shows, state media's attempts to demonize the protesters in the square, conspiracy theories involving Kentucky Fried Chicken, really, and the cynical use of religion as a goad to influence the vote on the recent referendum on the Constitution. Bessem sets real news clips of people predicting doom to music and delights in the panic-mongering.
Let's play a game together called The Great Terror.
The elections will come quickly, and only the Muslim Brotherhood are prepared for it.
The Ikhwan will control the country, enforce Islamic law, cut your hands and feet.
But if you leave it to the people, an infidel may come to power.
A Christian will rule. The Copts will control you. The Crusaders arrived in Mansoura. This is a good game.
The show's most profound resemblance to The Daily Show is in its resolute moderation. As when Jon Stewart suggested signs for people to carry at his rally to restore sanity.
Here's a quick one. I disagree with you, but I'm pretty sure you're not Hitler.
In a recent episode, Bessem, for the first time, switched gears, as Stewart sometimes does, from strategic snarkiness to sincerity. It felt like a big risk.
My face totally changes in front of the camera, and I say, there's been like a thick boot on everybody's neck for 30 years, and when the boot is lifted, it's expected that everybody will scream and you'll hear things that you don't like. Nobody is a saint and everybody is mistaken. The Muslim Brotherhood is wrong, the Salafis are wrong, the liberals who actually talk so much about democracy, they're not that democratic either, because it has this kind of conceited kind of note.
If you aren't pure in your liberality, yeah, then you're...
Something like that. I mean, if you are going to address the people in Egypt, not to use religion, they're not going to listen to you. You, as a liberal, you really need to know that you have absolutely no weight.
Egypt, says Bessem, is not extremist, but it is devout. And the only voices with the potential to unify the nation are those of religious moderates.
You have to actually step aside to let these people talk to them. And there's a lot of moderate people. So you need a Muslim moderate to come say, like, there's God everywhere. It doesn't have to say that you have to forsake your mosque.
And at that point in the episode, the camera shifts from Bessem's blazing blue eyes to scenes from Tahrir Square during the revolution, scenes of stunning unity among people of all religious stripes.
And I said, maybe I'm stupid, maybe I'm naive, but I think that something happened a few weeks ago where everybody got together and then we get the revolution and, you know, oh yeah, that happened. And then I say, like, this kind of Islamophobia will lead to Christianophobia, to liberalophobia, to democratophobia. I'll remind you what some people said about you. And I bring Omar Suleiman, the vice president, who said, like, Egypt is not ready for democracy. And I said, like, Hosni Mubarak, when he told Obama, oh, Obama doesn't understand the mentality of Egyptian. So I come back and he was like, yeah, you know, we have to be ruled this way. I mean, there's no other way. And I said, like, no, we deserve better. We need better. We are entitled to have better.
The stakes are monstrously high in Egypt right now, and the media's role is crucial. As Bessem's patron saint once said,
the press can hold its magnifying glass up to our problems, bringing them into focus, illuminating issues heretofore unseen. Or they can use that magnifying glass to light ants on fire.
By the way, the YouTube title of the Bessem Youssef Show is B+, after Bessem's blood type. Get it? Be positive. It's been hailed by some as the next big thing in Egyptian media. Tarek, who launched the show, predicts an almost certain future for Bessem Youssef on satellite TV.
This is why I'm panicking.
This is why you're panicking?
Yeah, this is why I'm panicking. Right now, I'm not actually voicing my opinion, but you can't just be in the middle being neutral. When you start actually to discuss current events, you will have to take a stand. You will actually have to piss some people. This kind of honeymoon will not last. Sarcasm here is in Egypt, in the Arab world, is very new. Once you make sarcasm about a certain person, this guy takes it very personally. You see Jon Stewart making fun of McCain and he's hosting him the next day. Right? Here, that doesn't work this way.
We are 5 years away. We are 5 years away from this.
No, we're actually 50 years away from this. Seriously.
Then again, many believe that what happened this year in Tahrir Square would take 50 years. And it might have, without the engine of the internet to help redirect the nation's hopeless passivity into popular revolt. The internet's power to organize is no longer in question. Its ability to inform still is. But not by Egyptian youth, who increasingly desert the mainstream media, dismissing its so-called objectivity as a pose, an excuse to evade unpalatable truths. For them, trust is based solely on transparency. And though this may send a shudder down the spines of established journalists, it is a true liberation for populations across the globe lied to from cradle to grave. This does not augur the end of journalism, but it does point to a future where expertise is embraced, but only when it can be verified, ignorant voices cannot be suppressed, and it falls to individuals to sniff out uncorrupted information. The authorities, who have spent the last half century or more subsidizing brazen fabrication, may howl, but for now, and for a long time to come, those who bother to listen will likely be laughing. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Sara Abdurrahman, whose fingerprints are all over this hour, Jamie York, Mike Wolo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, and PJ Vogt, and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keith. Extra thanks this week to Mandy Fahmy and Deborah Amos. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.